So for those of you who haven't met me, my name is Kristen Davis. I recently graduated with my PhD in philosophy of religion here from Southern Evangelical Seminary, and I did my dissertation on artificial intelligence and the existence of God. I have also worked in technology as a software developer for over 15 years. I did QA automation for the first 7, and now I do automation and systems integration for a financial tech company in their hosting and managed services department. And so I've had a lot of interaction and a lot of experience with what it takes to automate business processes, as well as automate, like, user actions in browsers and whatnot. And so it's lent support and some context for me to be able to parse out some of these ideas with a little bit more detail for those in the church, and then compared it along philosophical and religious lines thanks to my PhD in that area. And so what I hope to do for you guys today is to provide a little bit of clarity on the conversation that's taking place around artificial intelligence. There's been a lot of kind of almost inflammatory language. We have sentient beings. These chatbots are alive, or it's just a matter of time before they're conscious. These kinds of things that are coming out, the singularity is near. All of this kind of like scare tactic almost language in the media, and I want to provide you guys some categories so when you hear this is the technological thing that's been created, and then the claim about then what it will be, you'll have categories to be able to understand whether the evidence they're giving supports the argument that they're making. And so we'll also touch a little bit on the existence of God, because part of the conversation that's taking place is that artificial intelligence is starting. There's a little bit. This is not a large conversation that's taking place. But there are claims that artificial intelligence could be evidence of atheism. Kate Levchuk, in a Forbes magazine article from 2018, said that our ability to create a soul in silicon would be the litmus test for thousands of years of religious preaching. It would be an ultimate and non-disputable triumph of the scientific revolution. If we ourselves can create an artificial soul in silicon matter, the concept of a divine spark in our souls will give way to evolutionary Darwinism once and for all. It will be exactly the answer to the consciousness quest that will end the centuries-old debate on the existence of God. So we have some interesting things here. They are saying that if we could reverse engineer consciousness, if we could create something that can do all the things that a human can do, then that would be definitive proof that a human would not need God for its existence, that we could have evolved from other things. And so we're going to take that apart a little bit towards the end. We're also going to take apart, I think, a part that's really important in this quote is the artificial soul in silicon matter. If we could create that has very specific definitions of what is a soul and what is life that we'll come to towards the end as well. And so one of the things that I find really interesting about these conversations is that there seems to be a lot of equivocation of terms. So when you're having conversations with someone about artificial intelligence and technology and what it can do versus what it can be, those are very different conversations. You need to make sure that you're defining your terms. Because we as Christians have a definition for a soul. Philosophically, there's a definition of a soul. And then technologically, they have an entirely different definition of a soul, which we'll parse out a little bit more later on. But the three categories that I want to dive in first is to explain what are the types, philosophies, and some of our everyday uses. Because I think that this will give you a context to help parse out these conversations with a little more clarity. So what do I mean by types? What are the different kinds of technologies that are categorized as AI? So we'll dive into that and parse out what the different types are. Then also, what are the different philosophies? What are the different views of what AI could be or what it could do? How does this compare with tech categories with the same names? And so we'll see that artificial general intelligence, narrow AI, we'll dive into these topics in just a second, that they have a technological characterization as well as a philosophical. And if you're talking to someone about a philosophical thing and they're talking from a technological perspective, you're not going to be having the same kind of conversation. And then what are some everyday products and services that you have that have AI under the hood? Because AI is thought of oftentimes through sci-fi movies and media, that it will be something that's alive and sentient. It's this thing that's in competition or peer with humanity. But actually, AI is pretty much in everyday life. And so we'll see some of the technologies that have artificial intelligence under the hood. So what about types? Well, the first thing that I would like to parse out is software and hardware. So software is defined as a set of instructions, data or programs used to operate computers and execute specific tasks. Software is a generic term used to refer to applications, scripts, and programs that run on a device. It can be thought of as a variable part of a computer. And then hardware is that which the software is seated in. Software requires hardware in order for it to run. So if you think about your laptop, your phone, these televisions, those are all hardware. But they all then have software on them that allow them to do different things. All the different applications that you use on your computer, those are software. All the different applications that you use in the browser, those are software. And they allow more variability than the hardware allows. Now, this is really important in relation to the AI conversation because one of the arguments that's most frequently made in order to say that a singularity will take place is a hardware argument. And it comes from Moore's Law. Moore's Law is the argument that we have seen a significant amount of growth in compute and memory power over the last 100, 150 years. And as a result of this, we expect to see exponential growth. And therefore, it's just a matter of time when our hardware is able to compute at a fast enough power and have good enough memory, then we will be able to create a being that is more superior than ourselves and it will just take off. So that's a hardware argument for artificial intelligence. And the reason they make this argument is because of the reduced size and expense that has come with technology over the last 150 years. Now, my grandmother used to tell me about when they installed the first computers in her office. They were a whole room or a whole floor. It took a lot of compute and memory power to be able to do very, very simple tasks and a lot of space. Now, the same, actually more powerful computers than they had in an entire room, you each have in your pocket in your smartphone. Okay, so that's the idea. They're saying it's gotten cheaper and faster, and so it's just a matter of time that we get it to be so cheap and so fast that then it will be able to create a singularity and have it take over. So one of the things that we'll parse out a little bit further later on is that in that argument, they're equating compute power with intelligence. It's just a matter of calculation power is what they're saying. It's not what I'm saying, but that's one of the arguments that they're making.
And what is singularity?
Now, singularity, that's a good question, is the idea that at some point in time, artificial intelligence will become superior to humanity and therefore be uncontrollable by humanity and kind of take off and be its own superior being to humanity. And at that point, they call that point the singularity. All right? Now, but most of artificial intelligence is actually software. It's actually algorithms. So to make an argument that it's just a matter of compute and memory power is to collapse artificial intelligence just onto a hardware question. And so one of the things to keep in mind is artificial intelligence is both. It's a software and a hardware question because no matter how advanced and fast and how much data your hardware can store, you still have to have an algorithm that can do a variety of different things. And that's where that leads us into the philosophical question. When having conversations about artificial intelligence, typically it'll break up into two different categories. One being a technological conversation and one being a philosophical. Oftentimes people who are pushing back, I've noticed a lot in conversations I've had with people from the Christian community or from the philosophical community, they'll push back and they'll say, well, whatever it is that we're going to build, it can't be an intelligence because intelligence is da 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 da. But then they're talking to someone who's a technical person who does not necessarily have a Christian background and does not necessarily have any philosophical categories, and they'll say, but we can just build it. Let's just see if we can reverse engineer human intelligence and everything that a human can do. That's Daniel Dennett's argument. Let's try to backdoor our way into what a thought is by seeing if we can just reverse engineer thought and create consciousness with a robot. Those are two different conversations. One is a technological conversation saying, what can we build? And another is a philosophical conversation of what is that thing that we have built? What should we categorize it as? So I would never make the argument that we could not create a humanoid robot that was functionally equivalent to a human. In other words, I would never make the argument that we couldn't convince someone, create something that was so convincing that it was a human. Why? Because it's very easy to disprove that. They would just have to build it. But the question of what that thing would be if it was created is a different question. And so would it be a human? Well, that has to do with all the different categories of what it means to be a human. Humans are, in the Thomistic concepts, we would say humans are rational animals or intellectual animals. So it's not just the intellectual aspect, but also the animal aspect. And so there's life, there's nutrition, there's growth and reproduction, there's, what's the word I'm thinking more? Cognition and sensitivity and a lot of the subjectiveness of experience. And so what we'll see as we move in later, this is not even part of the conversation in the artificial intelligence conversation. They're looking for a very, to recreate a very specific set of actions within a human. And so when we have conversations about we'll create another being, we need to make sure that we're having conversations with people in the right venue that they're speaking. So if you're trying to convince someone that we're never going to create an artificial intelligence, and you mean we're never going to create an intelligent being, and they're saying we're never going to create a hardware and software thing, like you're not having the same conversation. And so that's where a lot of questions can come into play. Well, what do you mean when you say that you can build an artificial intelligence? All right, well, that's interesting. What would you categorize that as? And so parsing it out a little bit more. Now, within the technological and kind of like philosophical categories, it breaks down into three general categories: narrow, general, and super. I like to liken this to the evolution conversation. For any of you who have been in the apologetics world for any amount of time, you've heard that microevolution arguments, like things like adaptation with the Galapagos finches, are then used to be support for macroevolution. And so we've got a incorrect example being used to make an argument for something else. And everybody just dumps it under the term evolution. I think a similar kind of thing is taking place in the artificial intelligence conversation, in that the word artificial intelligence is being used in this really broad blanket kind of way, when really it has three very different meanings. The first one being narrow artificial intelligence. Narrow artificial intelligence is what you already see in a lot of everyday products. So what we have here are some suggested movies, shows, and music. So things like Netflix, Hulu, Prime Video, Pandora, YouTube, they all use artificial intelligence under the hood to suggest what you might want to watch next, what you might want to listen to next. Suggested shopping. So if you use Amazon or Walmart or any place where you buy online and it says, based off your purchases, we think you might like, this is using artificial intelligence behind the scenes. Alexa, Google Assistant, Siri, any of those have artificial intelligence. It's basically they have algorithms behind the scenes that are predicting based off past behavior. Maps and navigation apps take advantage of artificial intelligence algorithms and machine learning. Text editors, autocorrect search engines. So when your phone generates the wrong word when you're texting or when you're speak to text, that's all using artificial intelligence concepts behind that. One of the things that's really interesting about artificial intelligence is as soon as we create something that becomes commonplace, we stop categorizing it under artificial intelligence. Usually the things we like categorize and label as AI are the things that are still mysteries or things that are still cutting edge. But when they become commonplace, we stop using that, typically stop associating them with that particular term. So narrow AI is actually the only kind of artificial intelligence that we have right now, and all of them are algorithms with a variety of different ways that they learn that can do a single thing very, very well. Any of you who were here last night, Jeff went into a couple of different examples of things like AlphaGo or other other algorithms that are really good at trumping the leaders in those areas. So Go is a game. And the leading world master of that game has been trumped by this artificial intelligence. The same thing with chess. There's another one for poker. There is one that can play a variety of games. But all of these artificial intelligences, while they can do a skill set that a human has far superior than the leading champion of that particular discipline, they can only do the one thing. In order to get them to do something else, they have to be retrained and wiped. So they're not adding a second skill set. They're wiping and replacing the skill set. Even the things that can, or even the AIs that can do more than one game are still limited to a game. they're not able to also communicate, write, do mathematics, create art. They're still limited to a finite skill set. And so part of what we have in artificial intelligence today is narrow AI, where the artificial intelligence that we have are limited to a very specific discipline, and they can only do one, even if they can do it better than humans. What would be required for a general intelligence is for us to be able to come up with an artificial intelligence that could continuously learn. And what we mean by that is the ability for it to append on additional skill sets. There are two categories within continuous learning. One I prefer to call more like adaptation or refinement. That is something that we currently have today where you have an artificial intelligence, or you have an algorithm that's been trained on a particular kind of thing, and you can provide human feedback to refine it and make it better at the skill that it has. So this document recommender didn't identify what this kind of document was, so let me clarify it and provide it some feedback so next time it can. But it's not teaching the artificial intelligence a new skill set. It's not learning mathematics. It's not learning how to categorize an apple. It's not appending new skill sets in the same way that a child does. Imagine a child's learning process. You teach them math, you teach them language, you teach them how to categorize and tell the difference between an apple and a ball. These are all additional skill sets that are then appended on without losing the prior skill sets, even though they might be refined. So there's two types of continuous learning, the kind of refinement type, which we have now, and then the ability to append on new skill sets. And that's one that we do not currently have, but would be required for a general intelligence. Now, what is a general intelligence? Artificial general intelligence is the philosophical idea that we will be able to create something that is equivalent with humans, that something that would be a peer with humanity in terms of intellect and its ability to perform in the world. In order to do that, we would need this continuous learning kind of algorithm, because it would have to be able to continue to pick up additional skill sets. Artificial general intelligence needs to be a wide-ranging problem solver, robust, able to have robust obstacles, be able to implement around them, as well as be able to handle unwelcome surprises. Humans have a lot of setbacks and failures, and we come up with additional problem-solving strategies. And so we would need something that's more robust in order to be able to make that happen. So when I parse these out, I think of Alexa when I think of narrow AI. And I think of Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator when I think of general intelligence, something that's a peer equivalent with humanity, even if a little bit superior. And then when it comes to super intelligence, I think of the movie I, Robot, which these movies might be dating me. But I, Robot is the idea that there could be something that's greater than humanity, something superior to humanity that could then take over and control us. And that's kind of what happened in the movie I, Robot, where Will Smith finally eventually takes over and wins the day. Irving Good, a statistician, explains what is meant by artificial and superintelligence when he says that an ultra-intelligent machine be defined as a machine that can far surpass all the intellectual activities of any man, however clever. Since the design of machines is one of the intellectual activities, ultra-intelligent machine could design even better machines. There would then unquestionably be an intelligence explosion, and that intelligence of man would be left far behind. And that's what they mean when they say singularity. This thing would come to a point where it can recreate itself and advance, improve upon itself, and then leave mankind behind. So now that you have some categories, I like to dive a little bit into why I don't think artificial intelligence can be evidence of atheism. I think there's three reasons. I think there's a lot more than three reasons, but I think that these reasons are easy for you to package and then take and have conversations with people. Sorry, I'm just trying to check where we are on time. And so the first being that AI requires a mind for its origin. AI is not alive, and AI is not aiming at human-level intelligence. So AI requires engineering and design. Therefore, I don't think that it can be evidence of natural selection. Jose Cordero says that since the Big Bang, the universe has been in a constant evolution and continuous transformation. First, there were physical and chemical processes, then biological evolution, and finally now, technological evolution. So we see here we have an equivocation of terms. Physical and biological unguided processes is the chemical and biological evolution. technological evolution is design, and we have them admitting as much. So he goes on to say elsewhere, it is argued that natural selection with trial and error can now be substituted by technical selection with engineering and design. Humanity's monopoly as the only advanced sentient life form on the planet will soon come to an end when replaced by a number of post-human incarnations, including enhanced humans, transhumans. Transhumans are not what we're talking about in terms of sexuality. They mean like part human, part robot. Robots and cyborgs, as we approach a technological singularity, how we re-engineer ourselves could fundamentally change the way in which our society functions, while raising crucial questions about our identity and moral status as human beings. So, interestingly enough, they recognize that engineering and design are a part of this. I don't know how you couldn't if you're part of actually doing the engineering and design. But that raises an interesting point, that if artificial intelligence requires a mind for its origins, then it cannot be evidence of random origins. If you require an engineer or a designer in order to create artificial intelligence, it cannot be evidence of natural selection. It's actually, artificial intelligence speaks more to the requirement of there being a mind and a designer behind creation than it does in supporting Darwinian evolution. So back to our first slide where she said that if we could create an artificial soul in silicon, it would be evidence of Darwinian evolution once and for all. We've already seen it actually supports more in favor of design than it does that. The next point I think is really important is that AI is not alive. So this, there's another section to the artificial intelligence conversation that's a little bit to the side. That is the artificial life conversation. They work together, they take a lot of the similar principles, but it's a question about whether or not we could create life in some other kind of physical form, or if we could maybe recreate life ourselves using carbon, but not actually like cloning from an existing being, which I'm not really sure at what point, if you use the model that God gave and then you recreate it, even if you're not using cloning technology, I don't know how. At some point, you're still cloning, in which case you're not really creating something artificial. But that's a secondary question. So the artificial life conversation says that the hard or hardware A-life primarily is a conceptually sophisticated program of robotics. Its most traditional and extended approach is historically linked with the theory of control systems and communication, and more recently with the artificial intelligence program. He goes on to say that the classical approach to artificial life, which is closely linked to the artificial intelligence program, has always had as its central objective the development of robotic systems endowed with autonomy, which is understood in this context as the ability of a system for moving and interacting with its environment. So notice here, they're equating life with the ability to navigate one's environment and interact with one's environment. That's all they think that life is. So you're a Roomba, being able to navigate your living room and interact with your living room, that could qualify as life under this category. This is very different from how we would traditionally define life. Aristotle says that first of all, we must treat of nutrition and reproduction, for the nutritive soul is found along with all others and is the most primitive and widely distributed power of the soul, being indeed the one in virtue of which all said to have life. This power of self-nutrition can be isolated from the other powers mentioned, but it is not they that are from it in mortal beings at least. In other words, nutrition and reproduction, the ability for something to take in nutrients from its environment, reproduce and grow or shrink, those are the characteristics that have traditionally been considered what something is if it's alive. It's not, when we say animated being, it's not merely the ability to move about one's environment, but it's those abilities to take in nutrients and then process it and do things. Now, this is different than a battery. Why? Because taking in food from your, or nutrients from your environment and growth or reproduction is not creating, not appending additional things on. So it's not like adding, growing a robot by adding additional parts. It's the processing of the nutrients and the being itself with the single act of existence is growing or reproducing into another object. different from a battery where it's pulling its powers from external reality. However, it is the kind of thing that can sit on a shelf indefinitely and then be recharged. So a dead battery is not the same kind of thing as a dead human or a dead living being. Why? Because you can replace a couple parts and resurrect the battery. So its active existence is not in the single unity. It's in the constituent parts. Every piece that is making up the battery has its own active existence. The plastic, the silicon, the metal. All of those things exist in and of themselves in their own right, and then you put them together and you can have a charge and you can do a variety of things. This is different than with humans and part replacement, where there is one existential act. There is one act of existence in any living being. And we know this because we have beings that, because at some point that a being dies. Now this is different than part replacement. So part replacement in a machine, you can take a part and you can swap it out with another machine. But you can do the same kind of thing with organ transplant. But the way we can differentiate the difference between a machine and a human when we're talking about part replacement or organ transplant is by virtue of the existential act. I can take a battery out of my phone and sit it on a shelf for 2 years and then pick it back up, and it probably is not going to be the healthiest of batteries, but it will still work. Or I can take the parts apart and create a new battery with it. But it's still going to be alive. It's still going to function in its proper function. I cannot take a heart out of someone's chest and sit it on a shelf for 2 years and leave it alone and then put it in someone else. There's a lifespan because the organs of a human are drawing their existence from the being in which they are a part of. And so while we can transplant organs between people, the organ in and of itself doesn't have its own existence. Its existence is imparted to it by virtue of being a part of a substantial unity, of a substance that has its own unity and active existence. Now, all of the parts of a computer have their own substantial unities, the metal, the silicon, the plastic, all of the constituent parts. But they, when then pulled together, are not in and of themselves a substantial unity. They are an accidental unity. It's just a matter of them sitting, how they are arranged or sitting together that allows them to have the unity that they have. But they can be pulled apart and they will all still exist in all of their individual parts. The next part that I want to dive into is part of the artificial, so she said, if we ourselves create an artificial soul in silicon. Well, this is interesting because traditionally a soul is be considered the principle of life. Aquinas says, to seek the nature of the soul, we must premise that the soul is defining as the first principle of life of those things which live, for we call living things animated those things which have no life inanimate. So that nutritive soul we were just talking about is equivalent with life, or sorry, the nutritive soul, the nutrition that we were saying is life is equivalent with a soul. So only those things which have life have souls. In Aquinas and Aristotle, that means plants, animals, humans all have souls. Now, they don't all have the same kind of souls. We're not saying that plants are going to be redeemed by Christ's death on the cross and go to heaven. That's not what we're saying when we're saying soul. This is a philosophical category for discussing living being. Soul just means life, just means to be alive. So if artificial intelligence isn't alive, then whatever it is that we create isn't a soul. Okay? And that goes back to our earlier conversation of the difference between technological and philosophical categories. I'm not saying you couldn't create something that was really convincing that it was alive. But if it's not alive, no matter what it is, no matter how good you create it, it's not a soul. Okay? But also, I think one more thing that's interesting, so she said if we could create an artificial soul in silicon. Now here, this is a quote from Fuzz Rana from the pre-event last year where they were talking about UFOs and other things like that. He actually talks about how silicon is not even the kind of chemical component that could support life. So he says, carbon dioxide is soluble in water and air, which means that when a cell breaks down organic materials and creates the waste products of CO2 and water, the CO2 can diffuse away from the cell into the atmosphere, and it's a natural waste removal system. If a life form is based on silicon, the oxidation process is silicon dioxide, which is a solid material, and so that would kill the cell before it could even function. There would be so much debris that would accumulate inside the cell that if life was based on silicon, there wouldn't be possible because there would be no way to remove the waste. So in other words, even silicon is considered the closest to carbon, which is what we are made out of, and that is still not a good chemical component to build life off of. So not only would it not be a soul if it's not alive, it can't be a silicon soul because you can't have a living being made of silicon because of the waste removal process in diffusion. So the last large category that I wanted, we already kind of touched on this. I'm going to skip that one. So the last kind of category that I want to touch on is that AI is not actually aiming at human equivalence. They're just actually aiming at human action equivalence. So let's take a look at some of what they said. This is Daniel Dennett. Anybody who's been in apologetics for a while knows him. He's one of the four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse. he says that now we are, in a sense, artifacts, and I mean that in a good sense of the term. We have been created by the process of evolution with genetic and cultural, and what we're now studying to do in relation to consciousness studies is reverse engineer ourselves to understand what kind of machines we are that this consciousness can be true of us. So he's looking at humanity, and he has already predefined that we are machines, and the only thing that we're focused on is consciousness. John McCarthy, the man who coined the term artificial intelligence, and one of the founders of the field of computer science, is a proponent of artificial general intelligence. In describing AI research, McCarthy says that AI is the science and engineering making intelligent machines, especially the intelligent computer programs. An intelligent computer program is one that displays the characteristics of intelligence. So you have to know what intelligence is before you can create something that displays its characteristics. But McCarthy defines intelligence more broadly than Thomas. To McCarthy, intelligence is the computational part of the ability to achieve goals in the world. He goes on to say that there are varying kinds and degrees of intelligence, that it occurs in peoples, many in animals, and some in machines. So he here is defining intelligence as computation and the ability to achieve goals in the world. He's reducing intelligence to a very specific set of things. Traditionally, mankind has been referred to as a rational animal or an intellectual animal. So intellect is the distinguishing characteristic of what makes a human, which means that it encapsulates all of what it means to be a human. Over and above what it means to be an animal. And so intellection is not just the computational aspects, traditionally. We're going to skip that part. I feel like I've lost the slide here. All right, I'm just going to read this one. Also, it is reducing rationality to pure logic. So rationality is traditionally thought of in two different ways. It's the ability to have demonstrable conclusions, of which a denial would be a denial of first principles. So that's the traditional logic, the symbolic logic that you've probably been taught in a logic class. But it's also intelligible things that do not have a necessary connection to first principles. And so there's a lot of what we know philosophically that we can intuit or reason to that is not necessarily reductive to first principles. And all of that aspect is being left out of the artificial intelligence conversation. And then the last thing that I want to dive into has to do with subjective experience. Kijay Hole says that he does not assume that general artificial intelligence requires human-like subjective experience, such as pain and happiness. So what are we looking at here? With artificial intelligence... Oh, there's the slide. Sorry, they got out of order. With artificial intelligence, they're not aiming at creating a functional equivalent to humanity. They're aiming at creating something that can perform and behave and do the functional things that a human can do. They're not looking for creativity. They're not looking for experience, the subjective nature of experience. They're not looking at creating something that can posit for itself and think for itself inside without there actually having to ever be any action that follows. They're not looking for something that the cognition doesn't ever result in action. Like, think about all of the times. So I have a dog, and she loves to chase squirrels. Or not squirrels, lizards. She likes to chase squirrels, too. But she can see a lizard, and she can do one of three things. She can go after it, she can stay there and keep watching it, or she can decide to go do something else. So there's an intermediary between cognition and perception and action that allows for a decision for her to make and be able to do things. Humans have that on a much more complex level. Machines don't have that. They have what we could loosely call perception that then is supposed to result in an action. We would never see lack of action. And if we did see lack of action in a machine, that would be a failure or a bug. That's what we would perceive it as. Not as this machine has just decided that they don't feel like doing it today. And so there is a whole aspect of intentionality and desire that is missing that's not even a target of the artificial intelligence conversation. And so when I say that artificial intelligence cannot be evidence of atheism because it cannot be a stand-in for humanity in the origins conversation, part of that reason is because artificial intelligence is not, their goal is not to create an equivalent to humanity, just something that's functionally equivalent in terms of certain particular actions. And so I think that that's all I have time for today. I think we have 10 minutes for Q&A. I'm not sure what time we're supposed to let out. Perfect. Yes, I nailed it.
Can you tell me, from your understanding, what it means when an AI self-reports sentience? Like, what's happening under the hood when it does that?
Yeah. So essentially what I would categorize that out, and I do want to clarify, I am not an artificial intelligence developer, so I have not looked at all of these under the hood. But I am a software developer, so I understand what it would take to do this. It would essentially be a logging aspect. It would be reporting out, you could do it one of two ways. It would be logging out the states that it's in when it's doing whatever the particular part that is doing. Which would require someone to go in and code that when you do these actions, you need to report out that you're doing them. Or if you mean more in the terms of like the chatbot, which is like Google Lambda from last year, they were saying, one of the engineers was saying, oh, it's alive. I had this whole conversation and they printed it out. It was a big thing last summer. I think what that is, actually just kind of probability and its ability to understand the correct responses to specific input strings. And so one of the articles that I read on, it was on ChatGPT, not on Lambda, was that the chatbot models are highly sophisticated philosophy of language engines. And they essentially are looking at the probability of what the next string of words should be following whatever the current ones are based off the data set that they were trained on. Which is why, so long as you stay within pretty frequently used categories, you get normal responses. But if you go off in fringe areas, you get like made up. So there's a lot of conversation about hallucinations in artificial intelligence. It's because they've now, that's all they're doing. They're just trying to figure out the most probable next string of words. They're not thinking, this is what the answer is to that person's question. Let me now figure out how to communicate it to them. It's probability for, if I had to, I mean, that's oversimplifying it, but.
Question, you get a wrong answer and you get fake references. Where does all this come from within the software? It's like it just went out in left field.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the concept of, what I was just saying with it guessing what the most probable next format should be. So when you ask for references or you ask for it to give you something that should incorporate references, like if you ask for a research paper, part of that model is that a research paper is content with footnotes.
Yeah.
Then it knows what the format of a footnote should look like, and it's just throwing in, like, this is probably the next information that would be appropriate to put as a footnote here. Yeah.
One of the arguments for evolution was like, how does this species become this species? Well, just given enough time, millions of years, like that's an explanation. It seems like Moore's Law is the same thing. It's like, well, you know, we see some advancement in technology. It's just a matter of time when this thing, this machine or hardware or software, becomes human or whatever.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's the same kind of like nonsense explanation, but given enough, it's time. Like, that's how it is.
I think so, and I think it's also the result of reducing humanity down to computation And so if it really is that we are nothing more than our ability to calculate the best answers, then improvements in compute and memory power could eventually lead to that. And really, they have reduced humanity down to this view that that it is really a compute and memory power, because there's actually a quote that I don't think I have in here where they say that we are hindered and limited because we have such slow computers in our heads. And so for them, that's just what it means to be a human, is to be we're the most advanced computers right now, but one day we won't be the most advanced computers, which means they're missing a whole lot of what it means to be a human. And so they can make, yes, that time plus argument.
So this really applies to something in the pop culture, like data.
Yes.
We can't feel emotions.
Yes.
So that's sort of the same thing. The differentiation between artificial intelligence, it just means intelligence. It doesn't mean artificial humanity.
Right. Right. Yes, that's a good way to parse it. You had your hand up.
Yeah, I'm hearing more and more recently the term generative AI.
Yeah.
Where in categories does that fall? Is that more continuous or aligned?
So that's still narrow. Because each of the generative AIs can generate a certain kind of thing. So they are artwork or their literature or whatever. Even if they expand, they're still defined. They're not continuously appending on additional skill sets. So they're generative in terms of artistic skills in one large category, but then they're not able to come over and do, like, language.
Gotcha. Not like the next generation or advancement of, like, it's generating.
Right. Right. And usually, and what that's doing is it's doing the same thing as the language models. It's looking at all the available things out there and saying, all right, this is probably the most likely way that this should be sketched out or should be written based upon the data sets out there. Yeah. I think there was.
Just following up on what he had asked earlier. So, whoever coined AI, I don't know who did, McCarthy or whomever, the founders, but they used the word artificial. Quote evolution where, oh my gosh, we're going to drop the word artificial. Now we're just talking intelligence.
I think that is their goal, is for it to be, their goal is to create an intelligence. Now I think it also parses out differently between, when I say that's what their goal is, that's the people who are talking about this from a philosophical perspective. Maybe they would drop the artificial aspect. I don't know whether they would do that or not. But people who work in artificial intelligence on a day-to-day basis are not necessarily general or super intelligence philosophically. You can work in artificial intelligence and just think it's interesting and it's going to be a tool used for human purposes and utilities. Or you can hope that what you're building might be a part of advancement in creating a general or super intelligence. So there is a, when I say they, I mean the people who are talking about artificial intelligence as being a way of reverse engineering consciousness in relation to your question there. Yes.
What scares me about AI is it's being programmed, and there has to be a philosophical viewpoint that is programmed as well in order to do the kinds of responses that they produce. And the philosophy that they're embedding into it is nothing.
It will be if Christians get involved. And that's actually, thank you, wonderful segue. I've often gotten questions from people about just because we can do something doesn't mean that we should. And usually it's asked or said from a position of we want to throw up our hands and back away and not get involved. But actually the opposite is the case. Because you're right, it is going to be trained, on a data set, and who decides what that data set is the people whose philosophical view is going to come out. And this is why one of those things where they've put artificial intelligence on things like Twitter or some of the other open platforms, and they've ended up being like really racist so that they had to pull them down. Because there is no intentionality or personal view in an artificial intelligence. It assumes the view of the collection of data that it is being trained on. And so if Christians are not involved in this process, our worldview, our morals are not going to be at the forefront of that. And so I think it's very important that we get involved in these conversations and be a part of this.
So to follow up on that, then, even if people who are observing what AI is producing, like you say, going down the rabbit hole on whatever social media you want, will people recognize that, hey, this is going down the wrong path and that somebody should fix it, whether it be Christians or not? And I'm taking a step back from Christianity for a second just to say, Will people at large recognize the same things that people have recognized? If you watch the Social Dilemma movie, they recognize that this has all gone to worse and worse things. It just, the algorithms tend to do that.
I think,
are people going to recognize that?
I mean, this is pure speculation, but I would say they will recognize it as much as they recognize all the other ways in which our culture goes off the cliff. Like, this gender thing that's going on right now is taking, a lot of people are going to get hurt before culturally we're going to turn it around. So, yes, I think so, but like, I'm not comparing AI to Nazi Germany, but look at that. Like, that went a wrong way for a really long time before some people decided we need to step in and get involved. I think that's the way, if it went off the rails, it's going to take a lot of people getting hurt before. Yes.
How do we influence how AI develops?
Oh, that's a good question.
For non-techies.
That's a good. I think making sure that you understand what's going on. So be a part of the conversation. Keep yourself informed. I also think we need to be investing in technology. So we need to make sure that there are Christian companies that are developing this, and that Christians are involved in the technology, that we're training up people with engineering backgrounds who can go in and be a part of building the algorithms. For people who are not necessarily technical, I would say make sure that you're being a part of the conversation. Make sure you're having those conversations with people and saying, let's differentiate between what this is and what this can do. Because I think that that's going to be harder and harder to differentiate the more human-like parts get. And so if we are constantly making sure that we're categorizing the conversation in the right way, I think that that will be helpful. And then also there will be a legislation aspect of this. It came up in the talk last night. Somebody was asking the question about generative AI and copyrights. Well, we don't know what that's going to look like. So being a part of, that's another way in which we can be a part of it. I don't think we need to be afraid of it any more than we would be afraid of any tool. Jeff did bring up some really good points. There's a lot of dangers to it. In the same way that social media has been super dangerous for children, and it's something that we should probably limit child exposure to. I think that there's a similar kind of danger. I hate to make the analogy, but I think it's a really good one. Like the atomic bomb. We need to have that kind of technology because there are other people in the world who have that kind of technology. And that technology is not dangerous in and of itself. It's left sitting on a shelf, it's fine. It's the people whose hands it's in that is where the danger arises. So I think that is helpful in making sure that conversation seems to get into these weird, is it alive, is it going to take over the world place. And I think that's the wrong conversation to be having. So steering it back so that people are recognizing, no, this is not something that itself is probably going to take over the world. This is something that could be weaponized. And it needs to be handled by everyone so that not only the bad people have it. if that makes sense. And so we are actually past time. I will hang out here for a while if you have more questions. But thank you all.
Thank you.